that we might be motivated by that Spirit. And such are the things before us, my dear brethren and sisters, things of glory and of hope. But when we move into the book of the prophet Zechariah, we notice that the children of Yahweh are involved in a most exciting time. An exciting time because it saw the rebuilding of the house. The house that had been taken apart by Nebuchadnezzar and his army. And so we see a rebuilding. But that rebuilding spoke of much more. It spoke of something much grander. It spoke of the return of Yahweh's glory in a multitude. But before we look at these things, we must first of all consider the background. We must consider the historical background, first of all, in which Zechariah's prophecy is set. And so first of all, shall we go back to the book of the prophet Jeremiah, and chapter 25. And we remember in his day that over some 100 years before, the kingdom of Israel, the apostate kingdom of Israel, had gone into Assyrian captivity. They'd been taken away because they had backslid from serving their God. But the southern kingdom, thanks to some faithful reforms under such men as Hezekiah and Josiah, there had been some indication, hadn't there, my dear brethren and sisters, that southern kingdom might remain steadfast to the calling. But the apostasy set in, didn't it? And as we know, that revival was not lasting. So we pick up the record then in Jeremiah chapter 25 and at verse 8. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh of armies, because ye have not heard of my words. And those are the words of the prophet, aren't they? Under inspiration from the Father. And it was a sorry state. They had not obeyed the words or heard the words of Yahweh. But things were not all lost. But first of all, verse 9, behold, I will send and take all the famines of the north, saith Yahweh, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and an hissing and a perpetual desolation. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, and the sound of the millstone, and the light of the candle. And this whole land shall be a desolation, an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Yes, it would end. But first, Nebuchadnezzar would come, of whom Yahweh describes him, my servant. And that's very hard to swallow, my dear brethren and sisters. That a faithful servant of Yahweh might have to tell the people, of God's people, that Nebuchadnezzar is Yahweh's servant. It was a very difficult pill to swallow, was that. Yet Jeremiah had to speak it. He wasn't the only one who had that difficulty, was he? Because if we go over back to the book of the prophet Habakkuk, he saw that the ecclesia had slid back into apostasy. But we read there in, and he was told on that basis that Nebuchadnezzar would come. He says, verse 6 of chapter 1 of Habakkuk, lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. But Habakkuk could not understand that principle, why the Chaldeans of all people should come and take Yahweh's children away. Yes, they had transgressed, but surely they were not worthy of that. And so he says in verse 13, thou art a purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he? Yes, he couldn't appreciate that principle, could he? But that is all part of the divine chastisement, isn't it? That they might be utterly destroyed. That they might be an astonishment. That they might be an hissing. A perpetual desolation. That there will be no joy in the city. That the city would be as rubble. For 70 years. But because the God whom we worship is a loving and a caring God, such a discipline would not be final. Because at the end of those 70 long years, we have to imagine, if we can, the faithful servants, our brethren, as they struggle to maintain the truth in an apostate land, in a pagan land. And for all those 70 years they waited. But they knew that their time would come when it would end. And so we read there in verse 12 of Jeremiah 25, "It shall come to pass, when 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith Yahweh, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans shall make it, and will make it a perpetual desolation." It will end, brethren and sisters. The faithful knew that. Yet you know, as the faithful servants of Yahweh were there in pagan Babylon, they could see them about them, the great and the mighty army of the Chaldeans. They could see a city which was seemingly invincible, as 40, 50, 60, 70 years went by. As they come close to that 70 years, and they would see that, well, yes, Yahweh will release us, but they would ask themselves the question, how and why, how will it happen? Well, it happened suddenly, didn't it, brethren and sisters? In Daniel chapter 4, and at verse 25, we read, "They shall drive thee from men," that is Nebuchadnezzar, "and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men." And that was a lovely consolation, wasn't it, for the faithful? That was a wonderful comfort to them. And so it was that in one night Babylon fell. And so if we go over to chapter 9 of Daniel and verse 1, Here's the man of faith, Daniel. He knew that in Jeremiah chapter 25, that after 70 years would be accomplished, that Babylon would cease. We come now to the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. And Daniel knew that. Daniel had seen the Medes arising, which was of the seed of the Medes, which was made over the king of the, was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. And in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. And Daniel wondered, well, yes, I can see those 70 years coming. And he would wonder how it would happen. He would see Cyrus rise after about 70 years. Yet he would see Babylon entrenched, its defences up, its army strong. But things move fast, don't they, brethren and sisters? You know that as well as I do. A little over a year ago, Berlin was divided. A year ago, Ceausescu was in control. 2 months ago, Thatcher was in control. A week ago, Shevardnadze was in place. They fall, don't they, brethren and sisters? And they fall suddenly. And now, Daniel comes now to the time at the conclusion of the 70 years. He now sees a Babylon that was falling. What would the faithful look now? They would look now, wouldn't they, brethren and sisters, to the rebuilding of the city and the temple. Ezra chapter 1. Shall we turn there? Ezra chapter 1, and at verse 1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh Elohim of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. It's interesting, isn't it, brethren and sisters? We are in the first year of Cyrus. Cyrus had been promised. Cyrus was the anointed, wasn't he? We're in the first year now of his sole rulership, because Darius and Cyrus had ruled jointly for 2 years previously. Imagine the excitement now, brethren and sisters, in the ecclesia of God, amongst the faithful servants, as one Cyrus rules. Let's have a look, shall we, at Isaiah chapter 44. Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 28. That saith of Cyrus, and that's through the work of the prophet Isaiah, many years previous. Remember that Isaiah prophesied in the days of Hezekiah. He is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, Thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him. Yes, brethren and sisters. And Daniel there saw Cyrus, or rather Ezra saw Cyrus, in chapter 1 and verse 1. Just imagine the exciting expectancy now amongst the faithful in Babylon. But that was not all, was it? They did not only see in Ezra chapter 1 and verse 1 Cyrus, but they saw also that it coincided beautifully with the words of Jeremiah in chapter 25. That the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. And what did Jeremiah prophesy? That after 70 years, Jerusalem, Babylon would be punished. And verse 2. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh Elohim of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. He'd done that way back in Isaiah chapters 44 and 45, hadn't he? That had been prophesied. And Cyrus knew it. And so he says, Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Yahweh, God of Israel. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. How they must have thrilled, brethren and sisters, as they saw all these things now coming to pass in their day. We thrill when we think about them. hell must they have thrilled when they saw them. And so in the book of Ezra in chapter 2, we find there that in verses 64 and 65, we find that some 49,697 made the long trek from Babylon to Jerusalem. There was, my dear brethren and sisters, an enormous job ahead of these faithful ones. Our brethren and sisters, who for many years now had tried to maintain the truth in Babylon. But you know, it was not the work that would hinder them, as hard as that would be. It was not that that would cause them the greatest difficulties, but the hostility of Samaria. But nevertheless, as soon as they arrived, they got their priorities right. For chapter 3 and verse 3, they set the altar upon his bases, for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries. And verse 8, now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel and the son of Shealtiel and Joshua the son of Jozadak. So they started the work immediately, didn't they? So the work on the temple had commenced. It was a time, my dear brethren and sisters, of great joy. So much so that in verse 13, the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. Weeping, we know, because of what we read at Haggai, that the old ones did not see the house at its first glory. But as great as the faith was, as they maintained the truth of the captivity, in returning to the land, in the commencement of the building work, the hostility of their neighbours was too great. The work ceased. It ceased in chapter 4 and verse 2. Or they tried to make it cease in chapter 4 and verse 2. Then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers, and said unto them, let us build with you, because we seek your God. And that was a lie, because they didn't even know the name of their God, which was Yahweh. That failed, so they tried subtlety and bribery. And finally, the work was stopped. A decree came forth from Persia. The work had to stop. And you know, my dear brethren and sisters, we ask ourselves a question. Well, they struggled in Babylon. They trekked across that 500-mile journey from Babylon. They worked. Yet even great pressures were coming to bear upon them. Why? Why should that be? Well, you know, my dear brethren and sisters, Yahweh's workmen must be tested. We have many testing times in our lives. But of course, you know, the adversity that they now received was an opportunity for them to demonstrate their faith. Because we know that faith is only proved under adversity. But I suppose they did have a genuine reason to stop. There's a royal decree. The work shall stop. But they should have followed David's example, shouldn't they? He too was refused the opportunity to build. Not by the pagans, but by Yahweh himself. But consider his example. First of Chronicles, chapter 29. Chapter 29 and verse 2. Now I have prepared with all my might for the house of my God. The gold, the silver, the brass, the iron, so forth. He had made ample preparation, hadn't he? But not the three children of Judah in the land. And we now find ourselves, brethren and sisters, in the situation, in the historical setting. The children had come down to the land. They started the work and had been stopped. And at that point in time, we now are introduced to two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. And we cannot look at Zechariah without considering Haggai. And these two men work together to encourage the people to work. In a way, you know, the book of the prophet Haggai is an introduction to the prophecy of Zechariah. And so as these two encourage the people to work, it had its desired effect. In Ezra chapter 4, remember that the work had stopped. But in chapter 5, we're introduced to these two. Then the prophets, Haggai the prophet, and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. And so, we're introduced then to those two, aren't we? They not only exhorted the people by word, but also by example. Notice, they prophesied. And there were the prophets of God, in verse 2, helping them. So there is an example of faith and of works. And with these two men, we see a lovely mix of age and youthfulness in supplementing the work of the truth. If we were to turn now to the book of the prophet Haggai, in chapter 2, we see there that we see some reference that suggests to us that Haggai was an old man. Haggai chapter 2 and verse 3. Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do ye see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it? There's nothing. He knew it was in comparison as nothing. And we seem to have a little inference there that, well, Haggai himself saw it also. It seems to infer that he was one of those old men. Yet Zechariah was young. He must have been young, because in Nehemiah chapter 12 and verse 4 we find that Iddo returned with Zerubbabel. Now Iddo was Zechariah's grandfather. And so for his grandfather to return after the 70-year captivity, obviously Zechariah himself must have only been a young man. Now, when we consider these two prophecies, those of Zechariah and also of Haggai, we notice that they are very closely dated, very accurately dated. Chapters 1 to 6 of Zechariah, that's the subject our subject matter, and the book of the prophet Haggai are intertwined together within a 6-month period. Now we remember from Ezra chapter 4 and verse 24 that the work ceased in the second year of the reign of Darius. Now that's important that we remember that. The work ceased in the second year. Now let's have a look at the book of the prophet Haggai chapter 1. Remember, as a result of Haggai and Zechariah's prophesying, the people recommenced the work. And so in the second year of Darius the king, in the 6th month, in the 1st day of the month, came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jozadak the high priest. So we notice then that we are in the 2nd year. Exactly the same period as the time when the work stopped. And so very quickly after the conclusion of the work, Haggai prophesies. The timing is right, isn't it? The date is pinpointed quite accurately. And he says there in verse 4, "Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste?" That's the exhortation, isn't it, brethren and sisters, to work to rebuild the temple. A fine time to rebuild the home, but not the ecclesia. But they responded, didn't they? They responded at the end of the chapter. Verse 14, "Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel." At the end of the verse, "And they came and did work in the house of Yahweh of armies, their God." A month later, a second prophecy comes. In chapter 2, verses 1 to 9, in the seventh month, in the 120th day of the month. So a month later, there is another prophecy from Haggai. Now it is at this conclusion of this of Haggai's second message that we're introduced now to Zechariah. He now comes onto the scene. Now it's important at that juncture that we appreciate Haggai's message. It was an exhortation to work. The work they did. And in this context, therefore, we are introduced to Zechariah. In the chapter 1, verse 1, in the eighth month, in the second year of Darius. So the first two prophecies of Haggai, in the sixth and seventh month, now we're introduced to the eighth month. And what do we see? We see there a city that was lying in ruins. The rebuilding work had recommenced, but that was only, there had only been had there 2 months' precious work. There was still a momentous task ahead of them. And then one asks oneself the question, well, why should they have to struggle to rebuild a temple and a city that was once the glorious? Why did that city at all have to be destroyed? Of course, Nebuchadnezzar the pagan came down. He came down, destroyed it. But Jeremiah told us, didn't he, that he was the servant of Yahweh. And as a servant of Yahweh, therefore, Nebuchadnezzar turned Jerusalem and the city and the temple and the place where Yahweh had chosen to place his name, he had turned it to a scrap heap. As Yahweh's servant. Why? Verse 2. "Because Yahweh hath been sore displeased with your fathers." That was the reason why. And here before them, my dear brethren and sisters, was evidence. Evidence to the remnant of Judah of the backslidings of their fathers. They saw before them in the rubble the evidence that they had ignored the words of Yahweh. They had not hearkened unto the words. Their own fathers had refused the admonishment of the word of truth. And because of their father's rejection of it, they were now being forced to work under adversity and under great difficulties. And so Zechariah now exhorts the people of his day. He says, "Do as Yahweh says, and not as thy fathers did." And that's the exhortation of these first six verses of the book of the prophet Zechariah. And then we're introduced again to Haggai. Haggai chapter 2 and verse 10. chapter 2 and verse 10, verses 10 to 19, we have the third message of Haggai, which he receives on the 24th day of the ninth month. Notice, chapter 2, verse 10. And he receives another message again on the same day, in verses 20 to 23, on the ninth month. So the first two messages from Haggai are on the sixth and the seventh month. Zechariah chapters 1, verses 1 to 6. We remember, don't we, if we just want to remind ourselves, is in the eighth month. Now we come to the ninth month and the final two prophecies of Haggai. He says, if you work, blessings will be guaranteed. Verse 16. Since those days were when one came to an heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the press back for to draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20. But then the foundation had been laid, and they had worked. They worked, so what do we find? Yahweh declares, because they worked, he says, I will bless you in verse 19. And he says in verse 23, in that day, saith Yahweh of hosts, will I take thee. And he says later in, I will make thee. And it's the development of that principle, my dear brethren and sisters, that Yahweh will take his faithful servants, those that trust upon him, that he will take them and make them as a signet. And it's the development of that principle that we see in the visions of Zechariah. Not that all would be easy. We shall see in the next 2 days that there are traumas. There's always been traumas in the life of the servants of Yahweh. The reality of apostasy will be about us. But transcending all that, there is a promise. There is a realization that Yahweh will redeem his people. So we see in Haggai an exhortation to work and its response. A look at the glory to come. To look at the father's errors. That is, their natural father's errors. And if you work, Israel, blessings shall come. And then you shall be mine. And then we're introduced to the visions. In chapter 1 and verse 7 of Zechariah. In the 11th month of the second year of Darius. And we see now in these seven visions which were received by Zechariah in one night. We see the cherubim. We see the destruction of the kingdom of men. We see a few backward steps, don't we, also, with the ephah. But finally, we see the Jerusalem in its glory. But it's very interesting to note the symbols that are used in these visions. As with all visions, they have a peculiar significance to the person receiving the vision. And so it was for the symbols used here. They have a special relevance, don't they, for their own particular experience. For example, in the first vision we're introduced to myrtle trees. That's important. Because with a myrtle tree, it reminds us of the Feast of Tabernacles. And in Ezra chapter 3 and verse 4, as soon as they'd come back from the land, from Babylon, they held the Feast of Tabernacles, which involved the cutting down of the myrtle trees. In the second vision, in verse 20, we're introduced to four carpenters of a common sight. They were carpenters themselves, were Haggai and Zechariah, Joshua and Zerubbabel. The artificers, all around the building, all around the temple, building, rebuilding, repairing. Carpenters were about them all the time. And so with building work, we're introduced in the third vision to a measuring line. It's a tool, isn't it, of the carpenter's trade. In the fourth vision, we're introduced to Joshua. Joshua was there. Obviously, it's bits and type of one greater. But Joshua was there. He sees the stone. And the foundation stone had been laid. We've seen that in Haggai chapter 2 and verse 18. We see a lampstand, again associated with the temple that they were rebuilding. In the sixth vision we see a scroll. It just so happened to be the same size as the holy place in the tabernacle. And there they were rebuilding the temple. And they see that scroll fly away, showing them of the apostasy that would come. They've seen also chariots, and they knew of chariots. They'd been taken by a military power some 70 years earlier. And so we see that the symbols fit the occasion. They fit the historical background in which Zechariah's prophecy is set. And so we come then to chapter 1 and at verse 1. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah the son of Berechiah the son of Iddo the prophet, saying, the word of Yahweh. This had authority. It shall have the desired effect because Yahweh had spoken. You remember the words, don't we, from the book of the prophet Isaiah in chapter 55. Isaiah 55 and at verse 11. So shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it. Yes. The word of Yahweh had come now to Zechariah. And all these wonderful things of which we read shall come to pass. The faithful shall be bearers of spirit nature. And the word came, if we read, unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet. Zechariah. Yah has remembered. And he had. Yahweh had remembered in bringing the faithful out of Babylon after 70 years of long captivity. Berechiah was a blessing, being the blessing of Yah. And Iddo, the appointed time. Yes, Yahweh has remembered. He remembered what he had said, didn't he, in Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 12, that after 70 years the captivity would be relieved. And although the present situation in the time of Zechariah now spoke of hardship and difficulties, nevertheless the blessings that shall come will come at Yahweh's appointed time. And then he reminds them of the displeasure. Yahweh hath been sore displeased with your fathers. I suppose to the human mind that seems to contradict verse 1. But although Yahweh's mercy will be shown to the faithful remnant, unfortunately, many have failed through the epoch of man's dominion in bringing the faithful unto glory. And the evidence was before them, wasn't it? There was the stone on the floor. There was the city and the temple in ruins. There was evidence that Yahweh was sore displeased with their fathers. They were working amongst the evidence of that displeasure. But he's long-suffering, Yahweh is. Verse 3, therefore say thou unto them, thus saith Yahweh of armies, turn ye unto me, saith Yahweh of armies, and I will turn unto you, saith Yahweh of armies. Yahweh hath not cast off his people forever. We know that. And time again, the deity has seen fit to punish the unfaithful ones. But it's only as a means of chastisement, isn't it, brethren and sisters? We remember the words of the Apostle Paul in the Epistle to the Hebrews, and in chapter 12. Remember that chastisement is something that we must go through. Hebrews chapter 12, and at verse 6, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Yes. That Israel, or the ecclesia in our day, might return unto him, we receive chastisement. And so they suffered in Babylon. That some faithful ones might come through the fire. It's always been the case in an apostate ecclesia that there has been one here and one there that has held the truth in adversity. We notice, therefore say thou unto them, thus saith Yahweh of armies. It is he who says, turn unto me. They knew the consequences. They knew themselves that if they had not adhered unto the truth themselves now, they too would finish up as rubble on the floor. Be ye not, verse 4, as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, thus saith Yahweh of armies, turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. But they did not hear, nor hearken unto me, saith Yahweh. In hindsight, they knew of the extent of Yahweh's chastisement. The Israel, the 10 tribes, have gone. The majority of Judah was still in Babylon. They've gone. They're in the world. We know, brethren and sisters, in hindsight, that the vast majority of those faithful brethren, or the descendants of those faithful brethren then, were to go the same way in AD 70. Where do we stand? We see the example. And the exhortation to them. And the exhortation to us is this: be ye not as your fathers. And where the fathers have failed, in their inability to take the scriptures as read, may we also take heed then, brethren and sisters. Because their tenancy of the land then was only dependent upon adherence to truth. They never heeded, did they, God's prophets? And so he says, turn ye now. Turn ye now. Your fathers, verse 5, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? The fathers are dead. The prophets also. But the words live, the words are alive. But my words, verse 6, and my statutes which I commanded my servants the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, like as Yahweh of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. Notice there, that phrase, take hold. In the margin it says, overtake. My words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, not the prophets, did they not overtake your fathers? No, they didn't. But now some, a remnant, have responded and are about to be given a glimpse of the wonders before them. And now, my dear brethren and sisters, as we look now at these visions that are before us, these things of wonder and of glory and of truth, let us remember that the fathers transgressed. And let us keep these visions before us, that we might look and long and pray for the manifestation of Yahweh's glory. So then now, my dear brethren and sisters, we have tried in our way to set the scene, the historical scene. Remember that all this is given on the basis of the transgression of the generations that are past. And now there is a new generation, and they're given a new vision and a new hope. Not a new hope, but a regeneration of that vision. And so then, brethren and sisters, we look and long and pray, don't we, for those things to come.